my experience, the 1970 Italian film Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion isn't the subject of all that frequent conversation in cinephile circles. Nor do I hear much chatter about its director, Elio Petri. That's quite a shame, because this is a fascinating, unique, and memorable film that lays down a powerful and potentially disruptive message about the nature of authority and its ability to profoundly corrupt those to whom it has been bestowed. One partial explanation for the film's obscurity is that it's pretty difficult to categorize. Is it a warped police procedural? A dark satirical comedy? A murder mystery? A political thriller depicting social turbulence in a climate of impending insurrection? There are elements of all these genres and more at play here, but all the same, it's hard to reduce it down to a convenient formula, or to provide a simple explanation for what the director and his creative team were trying to express. The movie spoke powerfully to its times, and as you'll hear in our conversation, it continues to provide piercing, incisive commentary on events happening around us nearly half a century later. I'm David Blakesley, and on this 14th episode of Criterion Reflections, I'm joined by Matt Gasteyer. Please accept my invitation to join us as we proceed to launch our Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion. Okay, well, Matthew, thank you so much for getting online with me tonight to help me sort out Elio Petri's Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion. I think you probably know the story of what happened to me the last time I watched an Italian film released in January about a middle-class guy in the prime of life who kind of embarks on this kind of self-sabotaging mission when he seems to have a pretty good thing going, and then he just kind of, you know, pulls the rug out from underneath himself, you know. Of course, for listeners who might not know what I'm talking about, I'm talking about Dillinger is Dead, Marco Ferreri's 1969 film that seems to be cut from slightly the same cloth, a kind of a politically conscious bit of pop art that kind of gets into your brain, under your skin, and makes funny things happen, at least in my thought process. So, here we are, a year later, so to speak. Dillinger is Dead came out in January of 69. Here we are, a January film, or I think, actually, this was February, so well, there goes my whole premise. But anyways, this is a film that came out a couple years ago in a very beautiful dual format edition. Matthew, I'm here with Matt Gasteyer, and I'm going to give you a chance to kind of give us your opening take on this film, and let's just kind of get the conversation rolling.
Sure. Thanks for having me back. I think you put it really nicely in your intro there, comparison to Dillinger is Dead. Both of these movies are movies when I initially watched them, I thought, oh, that's a pretty good movie, and kind of just put it away and, you know, on to the next movie I was going to watch. Then it just, you know, weeks and months later, I kept thinking about it. And I do think that's that often happens with Italian films of this era for one reason or another. And I mean, I think we'll get into a little bit of why that's the case. But there does seem to have been something in the water in Italy in the 60s and early 70s that it was a dark time. And I don't know whether that's reckoning with their recent history. There's certainly parallels to Mussolini in this film, or if it's just the general modernity malaise that struck people in the in that era. There is a sort of a dark undercurrent in a lot of 60s Italian films. But what I think really strikes me about these late 60s, early 70s Italian films is that they start to get a little bit more of the humor back in there. And this film is just really just hilarious. I mean, and not necessarily, you know, laugh out loud. There's no pratfalls or anything like that. But it's sort of constantly funny and makes you think about things And this was my second time watching it, and I signed up for this discussion because I really wanted to revisit it. I purchased the dual format after only seeing it once and really just liking it okay. but it was years later, and I felt like I need to own this movie and I need to really dig into it and experience it again. And I really loved it this time. And you know, I'm very taken with Petrie's films. I've seen a couple of other ones as well. And I think he's got a really fun voice. I think he's perhaps not as acerbic as Ferrari is. You know, I mean, I think right. Ferrari's films are very, very dark, and I'm meant to unsettle. And I think Petrie's a little bit more of a provocateur in a playful way. You know, I think he's kind of gently prodding people as opposed to shaking them awake. you know, I mean, I think, but there's a place for both of those things. But I think this is so far of the films of his I've seen. This is the strongest, and I think it connects with me so much because it's very sharp and pointed. You know, it's focused, incredibly focused, and I think that aspect of it really shines through on a rewatch, just how everything in the film is so directly tied to its theme and has a real purpose. This is a 2-hour movie, but there's not a wasted scene in it. It's all of a piece. And so, I'm really excited to talk about it.
Cool. Yeah. This is a very disciplined film. And I think, both Ferrari and Petrie had that kind of, you know, focus and intensity about them. But I would agree on your take in that this film is playful. It's also a very accessible film.
Yeah.
It did win the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. And so it definitely tapped into that kind of spirit of the times, whereas Ferrari's Dillinger is Dead, I don't think it didn't really get much distribution outside of Italy or outside of Europe. Anyways, it never made it over to the USA other than maybe a few kind of obscure screenings. I think Ferrari is a bit more impenetrable.
Definitely.
And a bit more arch and quite a bit more confrontational. I mean, he's not that bothered by the fact that his films didn't generate mass appeal, that they kind of put people off or kind of leave them really confused and befuddled and maybe even generate a hostile reaction because they just don't maybe quite get it. This film here, I think anybody gets it, you know, and it's pretty obvious where he's going with it. This is a play on the nature of power. You know, reading some of the contemporary reviews by guys like Vincent Canby in the New York Times and Roger Ebert, you know, and even sort of in retrospective, there's a tendency to say, well, this is reflective of late 60s Italy. Well, and it is, but I can't help but watch it in today's political climate here in the USA and say this is about, you know, power and narcissism and kind of a class mentality that says if I'm on the inside, you know, I'm holding the reins of authority, I really am untouchable. And I think we are living through a historical moment of a leader, you know, our president, who, you know, I said on Twitter, this film feels like a prophecy of the Trump presidency because, in a sense, he is pushing so many buttons and acting so provocatively, so outrageously outside of the norms of what a person in that position, you know, the popular consensus anyways is how that person should be behaving, and yet he seems to be getting away with it. And so I don't want to go too far down that road, although if you want to, I'm willing. But I don't want to get totally sidetracked by contemporary political concerns. In fact, what it reminds me about our own political moment is that our society is always really kind of on the knife's edge, that if the wrong people or the wrong type of people get power, and there's not that checks and balance, and you know, they persist long enough, they will build in that kind of armor of corruption, that ability to exploit. So, you know, that's kind of maybe a more pedantic take or interpretation. This movie kind of gets that message across with incredible wit and flair. And it's brutal, but it's really fascinating.
There's a supplement on the disc from a critic talking about the film. And the first 10 minutes or so is about kind of the political context around the film being made. And I was thinking to myself through the whole thing, this is really interesting, and I'm glad to know all of these details, but it does not have any bearing on my experience of watching this movie at all, because this is so timeless. I mean, this film has no real ties to any particular moment or movement. It's very much about power and people who wield power and feeling like they are above the law. And regardless of the political context of it, which I think you very astutely point out and are very real at the moment in our country, just the literal representation of a police officer thinking that they are above the law is something that is constantly an issue. And, you know, it reminds me of Bowling for Columbine was recently announced for the collection. And mm-hmm. people have pointed out that, you know, some people say, well, this is a, you know, interesting timing for this. And people have rightly pointed out that it's always interesting timing for unfortunately, for a film about mass shooting to be released. And that's very much true of this movie. There's always something going on that is directly relevant to this film. And I think that's part of the appeal of the movie, is that it speaks to that universality, even if it is specific to some particular political moment in Italian history. And I think that's kind of what elevated it. And it certainly didn't win Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars over Tristana, by the way, the next film you'll be discussing.
That's right.
It didn't win because they were really involved in the radical political movements of the late 1960s in Italy. It spoke to what was going on in America at the time as well. And I think that is just something that will most likely and very unfortunately always be with us.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Nixon, the prototype of the Trump presidency, was in power in America. And even then, even before Watergate broke, there was a sense of certain, you know, lawlessness or ends justifies the means thinking. And that's kind of what you have here. And of course, you know, the Italians, they always do it with such impeccable style. And so this story is very engaging, just on that kind of, you know, the execution, the fashions, the incredibly awesome Ennio Morricone soundtrack, that little boing.
The spring.
just really, really engages me, and I'm sure many other viewers. So what we really have here is a bit of a thought experiment. It's not just a corrupt cop. It's not just a guy who's, you know, doing dirty business and just, you know, being smart and trying to avoid getting detected. In fact, it's just the opposite. He engineers a murder based on this idea that even if the evidence points directly at him, he is truly untouchable. He's pursuing this principle, if you will. He's not just trying to get away with things. He really wants to prove this point. So there is a sense of a fable or an exaggeration to prove that point going on here on the part of the filmmaker, who is himself and his lead actor, Jean-Marie Volante. They're both communists. I mean, they're both, you know, avowed left-wingers, anti-authoritarians. I mean, they're I guess, European Marxists, as opposed to necessarily Stalinist or even Maoist. They have this idea that people need freedom and liberation outside of the strong arm of authoritarian systems. But they are portraying sort of their version of this ultra-right wing, you know, power-crazed ideal that feels mission driven in this one of the three great tirades that the inspector, who is a nameless character, you know, repression is our vaccine, repression is civilization. Yes. It is such an amazing speech that he gives there, and it's just, yeah, I've watched that scene several times, and it's just the delivery and the impact is just remarkable. So he kills his mistress and basically puts everything right out there. Fingerprints, footprints, a thread from his tie. They're all laid out there. And the inspectors, the detectives charged to discover who did the killing, they look everywhere except where the evidence clearly points.
Right. And one of the really interesting parts of the movie on that front is the husband is sort of, it looks like he's going to be able to frame the husband for this murder, the ex-husband, mm-hmm. who they've been mm-hmm. separated. And he points out that if he sends an innocent man to prison for his crime, it's not really proving that he is above the law, that he must eliminate all other possibilities to the point where they could only think that it was him and he would still get away with the crime. So
right, force them to deny the obvious.
Yeah, that's yeah. So and that's the thing that right he's there. Not he's not interested in getting away with murder. He's interested in the idea that the idea of murder doesn't even apply to him. That it's impossible for anyone to conceive of that. And I do think there is sort of a class thing going on that front, because there is sort of one really telling line early on in the movie when he goes to the crime scene and he asks about the neighbor, and his another police officer says that it's a well-respected, I think it's a doctor or a surgeon or something, and says he's above suspicion. And it's the only time we really get, you know, that basically like the titular line. And I think there is something to be said about the idea that he feels like he, you know, he's getting this big promotion in the movie. He's moving from homicide to politics
which is a higher status
exactly.
job, right?
Yeah. But as he points out, it's basically the same thing now.
And that's his transitional moment there, you know, because in every subversive there may be a criminal, and in every criminal there may be a subversive. Right. So suspect everybody is basically his bottom line.
Yeah. But he feels like, you know, even though he's moving up in this system, that there is sort of this, you know, duality of the criminal and the police officer at play. And he has this serious inferiority complex. And this move is partially, I think, a class move. It's the idea that by wielding this power that he has attained through moving up in the ranks of the police, that he is upper class, that he is somebody who is respectable and is able to, you know, avoid suspicion by mere reputation. So I do find that interesting that they kind of slipped that in there, because I think it's really easy to just get carried away with just the police or government or official aspect of this. But I think there is something to be said for the idea that, like, people are there is this belief that, you know, the higher up in society you get, the more you're able to ignore the structures of civilization that are supposedly holding us all together, and that, you know, things no longer apply to you.
Well, the stability of society depends on the enforcers and the authorities not getting in trouble. So again, you know, another Nixonian/Trumpian statement: if the president does it, it can't be illegal, right? It's that they define the law, and that is the nature of corruption. Of course, corruption being the wielding of authority by people who do things that cut against the grain of conventional morality. And they do so with impunity, and they even do so with the fervent support of the you know, middle class guardians of public mores, so that when the authority, the authoritarian leader, does things that ordinary citizens would not be allowed to get away with, there's a phalanx of apologists running around behind them, explaining why this is not a violation of the rules that the rest of us ordinary plebeians are supposed to obey in our everyday life and in our conduct and our relationships with other people. And so, yeah, that's basically the very interesting dynamic of this film.
No, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I think that the you know, the aspect of him doing this at the moment when he gains this extra level of power is very reflective of our president, in the sense of, like, mm-hmm. it seems like the more, you know, the, I mean, certainly the closer he got to the presidency, the more unhinged he became. And I think as he's, you know, been in office, it's become more and more apparent. And I think that that happens when you are a deeply insecure person, and in this situation, it's revealed in flashbacks that his, you know, part of the reason why he killed his lover is because she made him feel insecure sexually, or it violated his masculinity. And
she pursued relationships on her own terms. She sought gratification for what made her feel good. So right. She had sort of had her fill with this kind of aging, you know, mediocre lover, this sort of conceited narcissistic man. And, you know, he gave her some adventures, some thrills. There's a little bit of, you know, in those flashbacks, a little bit of a kinky role-playing S&M type of thing going on. But, you know, she's a libertine herself, and she sort of had her, you know, she's had enough of that. Now she wants to get with a younger guy.
Yeah, or
a
well, more she was only attracted guy. To his power.
And, exactly, and she's the, exhausted that. Yeah, now. There's nothing more to be discovered, right?
Right, and the guy upstairs has a different kind of power. He has a revolutionary magnetism. He betrays the law in a different way than running stoplights for no reason.
Yeah, and he's a young stud, so there's probably a little bit more of that erotic power as well.
Yeah.
But you know, that point you brought up earlier was exactly where I was going too, about the underlying, you know, insecurity of this man, that as for all of his arrogance and swagger and bluster, and for the very real authority that he wields, he's just, you know, gnawing away on the inside because he understands kind of what a fraud he really is.
Yeah.
And it just kind of corrodes him. And so there is this kind of bottomless pit of need. And again, I'll let the listener draw the parallels for themselves before I belabor the point. And I also, what do you think about just sort of the need, not only to have, you know, to conquer women, but beautiful women. I mean, he saw, you know, the skin of a Roman courtesan, and, you know, and in that one exchange he has with that other kind of senior cop, and when he acknowledges that this murder victim, well, I had an affair with her, and do you think I should tell them about this? And he's just, his buddy's like, so was it good?
Yeah,
you right. know, he's got that little lewd expression on his face, and they're puffing on their cigars, and he's kind of visualizing what it'd be like to make love to this gorgeous and now dead, you know, murder victim. And so there is that kind of whole, you know, power play of possessing, if you will, beautiful women. And of course the consuming rage and jealousy that erupts when you recognize you don't have exclusive control over that same woman.
Yeah, I think I think I've seen the other two Petri films I've seen are Property Is No Longer a Theft and The Tenth Victim. And I
just watched The Tenth Victim yesterday.
Yeah, it's a really fun watch. That's on Amazon Prime for anybody who wants to watch it. And I think all three of the films have that sort of sexual dynamic in common, the male insecurity. And I mean, I think that there's a deep Freudian thing running through this film, and which is, you know, I think typical of of the era of filmmaking. But I think I don't necessarily respond to it on a personal level, but I do. It does make sense to me, the interplay between that, the power and sexuality and the male insecurity surrounding that dynamic, and the need to wield power over women. And I think that aspect of it, you know, if I had to point to a element of this movie that I find to be a little weaker, I would say it would be the relationship between the inspector and his lover. You know, I think it wasn't necessarily needed in the story, but it does play into it very nicely. And I think that exchange that you're talking about with his superior, I think is a great moment. And I do think the way he weaves in the flashbacks as well really builds the tension as you're kind of propelling yourself towards this this finale.
Right, that the murder wasn't just this kind of cold-hearted experiment. You know, she's just a disposable woman that I will kill for my own twisted, perverse, kind of experiment
here. Right, and you know, because they show up at the beginning and you don't know what's going on at all, and she asks him, how are you going to kill me this time? So initially, you have no idea what's going on there, or what their history would be that would necessitate that exchange. So obviously,
it is kind of a grab you by the throat, no pun intended, but right. Boy, what a way to get you hooked into a movie.
Yeah.
Right? A little basic instinct in reverse in some ways.
Right.
But so we are now he's got a motive, because he does find himself in competition with these young subversives. There's the husband, the frameable victim. There's the young revolutionary, and so that's kind of takes us into the second, or maybe the final, I guess it's sort of the second act of the movie, where they start getting into the kind of revolutionary politics. And again, you've got a little bit of an age or generation gap here. The inspector's, he's not fully a generation above the young rebels, but he's certainly, you know, he's not in his early 20s by any means either. He's probably, you know, maybe 10, 15 years older than them, moving up, though, into an echelon of society that most of these young men probably will not achieve. What do you think about some of the some of those political overtones and just kind of the frictions that exist as he's interrogating, for instance, that a couple of the subversives that have been taken into into detention by the police?
Well, I love that you mentioned the age gap between them, because it allows me to bring up what really struck me during this movie, which was the similarity between the inspector and Don Draper in Mad Men. You know, I mean, I think that well, obviously, just the clothes,
the look, all that.
Yeah, but right. I think, sharpness. And he does look even a little bit like John Hamm, I think. But I think there's, you know, that aspect of being a little bit behind the times. You know, there's this other generation coming up, and you're not really sure what to make of it. You know, in the pilot of Mad Men, when he's looking at the lemon Volkswagen ad, or going to visit his mistress in the village, and meeting all the beatniks. Like there's this sense of wanting to belong, wanting to have that kind of energy and power, mm-hmm. ultimately cultural power, but not knowing how to do it. And
right, he really can't grow his hair out.
Yeah.
He really can't give up his sharp suits and kind of have his, you know, shirt halfway unbuttoned down his chest and let it all hang out. Even when they go to the beach, you know, he's still pretty uptight, and he ends up with a mouthful of sand for all
right.
that. So, you know, he's kind of made his commitment. He's gone the straight and narrow path. Well, not real straight, but you know, definitely he's part of the system, and he cannot really check out of that now. And there's a resentment that comes not only with aging, but just, you know, opportunities that our own decisions in life kind of forbid us from pursuing.
Right. And I'm sure we'll get into the ending, but I think that you can take that all the way to the ending in the sense that not only is he unable to break free of the system, but the system needs him. It needs these kinds of people. And if you strip away all of the gender dynamics and cultural zeitgeistness of Mad Men, you get to identity essentially. And I think this movie is very much about identity and his sense of you know, where do I belong in this society? Am I just an average policeman intended to hold up the law, or am I the dam between civilization and revolution? You know, am I the last vestige of decency? And does that in turn allow me to do whatever I want in pursuit of that?
Yeah. Does he believe the bullshit that he's spewing there?
I mean,
is this a lie, or is he really onto something? And I mean, he's surrounded in his own way by yes men who are like, yep. Yep, that's it. That's how it is. That's what we got to do. So he's being egged along in this ruse, in this facade, but the facade has enough cumulative power that it becomes its own reality. Like, he really is a boss. He really is able to, you know, send people to jail or worse. And he's even able to bend the law to suit his own twisted purposes, and do so again with impunity. So it becomes this very intoxicating kind of mind-bending trip that he's on, that he takes us on as we kind of go through all these machinations and reflect on how we see power playing itself out in our own lives and in the lives of people and societies around us. I mean, you think about contemporary events and this young man, this Austin bomber who was, setting bombs and killing people. And now just, as we're recording this today, the news comes out, this poor tormented young man who's just agonizing with his life and what a confused, heart-wrenching story, it's like we just can't let his identity as a terrorist bomber settle in and just stay it there without, conjuring up some sense of pity. And yet if he occupied a different niche in the social demographic, he would be completely villainized and there would be no alternate narrative to cut against that. And it's kind of shocking and sad and discouraging to see these same kind of cultural blind spots just perpetuated over and over and over again. But cinema like this, I think, is trying to jostle people out of that complacency. And you think, boy, this is a movie that's, 48 years old now, and it's been around. It won awards, but there's something within generations and just within the human species that just feels like there's a resistance to this type of message as well. So movies may not exactly, lead us to a utopian society, but they certainly can open our eyes to things.
And sure. I think that's a subject we could talk about forever, but because I do think, you have to ultimately ask yourself, are we just banging our heads against a wall when we as humanity make art like this, obviously, Guernica was painted, but there's still war.
Sure, and the misery and the suffering and the futility of it all. Wars are monstrous, cataclysmic events. This is about power and abuse of power in a much more mundane, pedestrian, setting aside the fact that a tragic and easily avoidable murder has taken place in this story. But it's about how the system protects itself and is really resistant to outrage and what seems like should be a pretty blatant and obvious grounds for dismantling it and at least holding accountable the individuals who abuse that power. And yet there's this void that just kind of closes those gaps and says, no, we're not going to let you take the whole thing apart until it gets to the point of, you know, like I say, war and violent revolution. And that's what you see happening again towards the end of the film. There is a counterforce. There are these angry mobs of people trying to, you know, stir things up. And if they have to drop some bombs and right. burn some cars and throw bricks at cops, well, that's their effort to try to disrupt that system. And yet the system has its own way of countering all of that. And sometimes it means setting up and incriminating the leaders of those counter movements, those revolutionary efforts. And that's what you see happening here as well, as the system again protects itself.
Well, and if he had, you know, at the end of this movie turned revolutionary, I don't think they would be as quick to, huddle around him and, you know, rally for him. You know, they're only as loyal to their own as their interests are, as far as their interests go. And so, and beyond their interests, they really don't care what happens. You know, if something terrible happens, if a woman gets her throat slit, well, was it a woman who was working to stop the revolution? Because otherwise it's not really that important to them.
Right. No, she's really just kind of an expendable right. libertine. You know, she's beautiful and it's
a shame. Kind of sad that yeah. That, it's a
yeah,
shame.
Yeah.
She had a beautiful body, right? That's what they say.
Right. Right. Yeah. Somebody could have really enjoyed her for a long time, you know, but it's a waste, kind of a hideous thought. So, yeah, do we want to maybe veer towards the conclusion that it, to me, it sort of had, well, there's kind of a dual ending, right? There's kind of a dream sequence that you don't quite pick up on it when it's first happening until you sort of see the guy sort of, he's laying on his bed and he wakes up. But
right.
The first one is kind of this surreal, slapsticky, it kind of got me thinking about the deleted food fight at the end of Doctor Strangelove, you know, kind of where the inspector is basically confessing and he's just humiliating himself and just kind of going through this kind of punitive ritual. You know, he's eating salt out of the palm of a hand. he's almost like pleading and begging to be punished. I mean, and then we'll get to the second or concluding scene, but what'd you think about all of that? That was just kind of a little bit of a surreal off the chain moment. And at first I'm like, oh man, are they just going kind of bonkers here? But you know, when they put it in the sequence of a dream, and I think there may have been some eluding of the sensors or something involved in the strategy there. It's a pretty complex ending there.
Yeah, that's so, an interesting point. I could definitely see that being the case. I mean, I think that sequence is great. And I really like, you mentioned earlier that there's a sort of a mind-bending quality to this film, which I think most people, if you hadn't seen the movie, would think, okay, well, are we talking about, you know, Black Moon or Valerian or Week of Wonders or something? This isn't a surreal film, but there is, you know, a certain mind-bending quality to the narrative even before this sequence, which is pretty out there. And to Petrie's visual approach as well. You know, the way he shoots spaces, the way everything's underground. at the police station. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you get to this moment, it's not that surprising, and it feels a little bit like a frog being put in cold water that's heated up. It's like you don't really notice how crazy it is until he's eating salt out of somebody's hand.
right. And he's getting very emotional and he's being denounced and kind of kind of mock beaten and kicked around by his colleagues. And it feels kind of unhinged here and not exactly how you would expect a group of police officials to be acting. Right.
Well, and also he walks out of the room and there's just these the 10 guys in black suits huddled around. Some of them are sitting, they're just staring at him. It's, it's pretty surreal, just immediately, and very ominous, almost like a David Lynchian kind of thing going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, and then he snaps out of it.
And then it's a lot more like sort of the ending of The Godfather. You know, the men gather around and they kind of acknowledge what's going on, but then the curtains come down and it's like, we will take care of our business,
right?
behind the scenes, and no truth will emerge after this meeting. Only we, the initiates, will know what really went on there. And again, I think it's just another depiction of how the system sort of closes in, yeah, and gathers around itself. Now, if he had gone if he had defected to the revolutionary side, they would have just, you know, eased him out of there and he'd be on the hit list, and, you know, they would just chalk it up to, well, he wasn't really one of us to begin with. You know, that's, again, right, the nature of power, is to rewrite history, and just to sort of disappear those who maybe once fit in but no longer do. And somebody else, more of a true believer, would be elevated to take that spot and fill the temporary void in that seamless shield that the system creates around itself.
It's interesting that you mentioned The Godfather, which I hadn't thought about, but is an accurate comparison. And I was thinking about why I hadn't thought about that. And I think it may be the music. You know, the music, yeah, in The, yeah, Godfather is obviously, it's so mournful and
it's sentimental,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is nostalgic. Kind of wacky, right? Yeah, and this is so, mm-hmm, playful. And it's got that great spring. But I mean, the whole thing is really, it's a very mischievous score. And I think so even in its darkest moments, you're not getting this sense of a tragedy taking place. Everything stays very light. It becomes this is to a certain degree a candy coated cyanide pill of a movie.
It is, yeah. We're kind of screwed, so let's just chuckle our, yeah, way through life and deal with it.
Yeah, although I will say, I think that's true, but I do think it was interesting to see. There's also an interview on the disc with Petri from French television. And, you know, I'm doing a podcast currently. I'm watching all of Kubrick's movies, and Kubrick suffers from this as well, where there is, you know, a real, there is a, for sure a cynicism to his films. But I've always seen a lot of, you know, hope, striving for something in humanity, something better.
Yeah.
And I think, and Petri voiced that. And I think, you know, right, he said in the film, like, you know, you don't make movies about something that you don't love. You don't, you know, you depict society and its ills because you love it. And this movie is genuinely trying to make a difference, even if there are still, there's still as much corruption before this movie came out as after. I do think you can only do so much, I guess. and
even if this movie just kind of individually enlightens us to the nature, right, of authoritarianism, and to detect and call out, and to whatever extent we can, sidestep or even to some degree disempower the authoritarians in our lives, whether that's on the local personal level or who we do choose to support politically, or what kind of causes we want to lend our energy to in terms of making other people aware of, you know, base your vote on this, think, yeah, about these interests and where this particular leader or movement would take our society if their vision for, you know, America or our local or state government or whatever was carried out. And we do need people to think those things through and not treat politics like a fucking reality TV show, which I think unfortunately the entertainment culture that has been, you know, promulgated in our society and, you know, and many others for a long time, it kind of boils down to those kind of elements there. So, yeah, I do believe that there is a construct of social purpose being pursued here and to some extent achieved. And that's one of the reasons I'm very happy to bring attention to this movie, because I feel like it really does speak to our times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And well, and also, I mean, I think art is often a reflection of the society that created it. And this was a real moment in history, you know, perhaps not the people who were in power at the time, but the people, mm-hmm. the generation of politically active young people and artists were waking up to these sorts of things and were more aware than they were previously of this kind of power being wielded. And so in that sense, you know, he was speaking for a generation of a movement. Unfortunately, it wasn't a larger generation of those people, because all of the apolitical people who were that age eventually grew up and elected horrible people. But that's a whole other that's a whole other conversation.
Yes,
but I think you know the people who were politically active, who were trying to change things and did change things to in a lot of social ways, if not eventually political ways. Were speaking through artists like Petri and Ferreri. And so I think from that perspective, it is a interesting window on the start of a lot of the social consciousness and political consciousness that is still with us today.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good note to kind of wrap up our conversation on the film, that this is a film that definitely made an impact on me. I know I'm moving through these films somewhat, not a breakneck pace. I definitely want to sit with them.
I can show you a breakneck pace, David, if you want.
That's right. Yeah, you've got a whole blog about that. But I do feel like this is one that's going to stick with me. I like your sort of early take there. You watched it. It's pretty good. And then it just kind of sticks in your craw there a little bit, and you find yourself thinking about it a little bit further down the line. And I think it'll probably have a very similar effect on a lot of viewers and listeners out there. So you know, this also, just as a piece of product, if you will, is really makes me miss some of those gorgeous dual
it's
format
true.
Packages.
Yeah.
This really is a very nice little, you know, slip case with kind of three variations on the artwork. You got the big fingerprint on the front cover, the handprint. Yeah, some of the visual dynamics. I mean, I love that scene of where the inspector's walking through all those blown-ups of fingerprints and clues and evidence. It's just very, very op-arty. There is, you know, I've already said, a lot of cool Italian style in this, and those subterranean caverns, and just, you know, just really cool bits here. But that production design really comes through in the packaging as well. You know, the booklet, you know, it's got the foot, yeah, the shoe print on it, and it is a nice little booklet, very nicely illustrated. You know, boy, those were the good old days.
It's true. Yeah. You know, this would definitely be a Scanavo these days. Yep. For sure.
Yeah, with a little you know, maybe 4-6 page fold out there, and that would be it. So yeah, but I'm glad we got this while we did. So yeah. Any other supplements, anything else that you want to kind of, you know, point out or final thoughts on the film?
The one thing I forgot to mention was just the similarity to The Conformist, the Bertolucci movie as well.
I have not seen that, but I've seen some of those. Yeah, maybe play that out a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think you know, I've only seen that movie once, and it was a few years ago. But you know, obviously, like, there's a lot of political corruption and elements of that in that movie. It's kind of in the reverse, in the sense that he's you know, buying into this corrupt system. But there's a lot of similarities visually as well. The aesthetic is really similar. There's a lot of like bombed out areas in that movie, but the similarly sort of severe architecture, lots of pillar, you know, cement pillars, and it kind of is almost like the dystopian version of this pop art reality that Petri is depicting here. And you know, I think it would make a very nice double feature, the two films. And of course, again, just late 60s, early 70s Italian movies. I think they have that thing where they just kind of get under your skin a little bit and wriggle around in there and see what they can find to stick in your craw.
Yeah, well, it's definitely one that's gonna demand some revisits. I definitely want to look into more of Petrie's work. Again, The Tenth Victim is the only other film of his that I've seen, but even some of the titles look pretty interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, Property is No Longer a Theft is available from Arrow in the UK. It's okay. Not as good as this is, by all accounts, his best film. I really enjoyed both of those movies quite a bit. And Property is No Longer a Theft is a little messier. But it deals with it has a very similar tone and deals with a lot.
Is Volante in that one?
No, but it's kind of like it's about exactly what it sounds like. So it's just, you know, it's about a guy that decides to rob everything from this rich guy. So it's just kind of like, you know, along the same lines, but instead of power, it's about wealth and property. There's a middle movie in between the two of them. I forget the name of it right now, but they're kind of thought of as a bit of a trilogy. But that one is a little bit harder to see. I haven't tracked it down yet.
All right. Well, that's some interesting threads to follow up on there. Kind of the Marxist checklist: wealth, power,
yes, exactly.
Property.
Well, the other one is about the working class.
So, okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. That pretty much covers it. Excellent. Well, thank you, Matthew. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I know you're on the queue to get back in here soon enough. So, tell the listeners a little bit about what you've been up to. I know you just released A Clockwork Orange on your Complete. Just tell us what you got going on.
Yeah, I do a podcast called The Complete, each season is a full director's filmography. So it's one episode for each movie in chronological order. And so I just started. So as far as everybody knows, the podcast is just The Complete Stanley Kubrick at this point. but we were up to Clockwork Orange, and we are going to be recording Barry Lyndon soon, so we only have four more to go, but it's been really enlightening, and if people want to check it out, I hope you enjoy it, and let me know what you think. But
yeah, I made my little cameo.
Yes, you were on 2001. Brief is an interesting way to describe that conversation.
I just dropped a few comments on
it. It was great. Travis and I were really pleased to have you on the show for that episode, and it's definitely my favorite of the ones that we've done so far.
Well, I think you've done a pretty solid job. I definitely look forward to the rest. I mean, you're probably not quite ready to start talking about what you got ready after Kubrick there, but we'll keep the suspense growing.
I don't want to say it because I don't want to fully commit. I'm not fully committed yet, so we'll see what I do.
Yeah, what, like five films left to go?
Yeah, so yeah, I got some time to think about it.
Time to weigh your
options. Yeah, but thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure, and I look forward to coming back.
Cool. We will have you soon, Matt. Thanks.
Thank you.